Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Who Do You Think You Are? The brand new podcast series by A3 Communications, the data storage industry PR agency. My name is Fred Monson, and I'm the founder and CEO at A3 Communications. With us today is Andrew Maloney, currently CMO at Soft Iron. Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Hi, Fred. I'm doing great. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So you have a very broad track record, one that has seen you develop emerging and established brands. You've worked in-house at 3Com and RSA, part of EMC, and on the agency / consulting side. So why did you become a comms specialist, and how long have you been in this line of work?
That's just a polite way of saying I'm really old, isn't it?
No, it's not. We've been around for pretty much the same length of time. So absolutely, yeah. We're youngsters.
No, well, I actually started off by doing a degree in marketing, which is pretty rare, I suppose, back in the 90s, because there were only about two places you could do a degree in marketing in the UK at that point. But I did with a kind of minor in engineering, which led me into doing one of those kind of placements that you do as some of those degrees. Spent a year working in the networking industry at the company that was acquired by 3Com. So I kind of went straight from university and into working in a division of what became 3Com in the networking space. The rest is history, really. I've been working in IT or marketing in and around IT ever since. So that's what, 30 odd years now, I guess. And in that time, I've kind of worked in both startups and large corporates. And I think, you know, the interesting thing for me, and a little aside, I suppose, when I was doing my degree, I did spend a summer testing out doing B2C marketing. I worked for McCain Foods up in Scarborough, where I grew up, and got a summer placement working there, helping the marketing team figure out the next great oven chip and the next great pizza. And that was enough for me to figure out what kind of chips I wanted to focus on, to be honest.
Yes. So you do lots of product testing then?
Well, one of my jobs, actually, this is definitely an aside, but one of my jobs was to drive to the nearest city, which was York, take a company car and drive around all of the supermarkets to pick up whatever food decided they were going to test that particular day. So I'd rock up, and if it was ready meals, I'd rock up at the checkout with 27 ready meals and nothing else in the basket, and they thought I was a very sad individual.
Absolutely,
but
yes.
That's my job. But yeah, no, I mean, the thing about tech and the reason I focused on tech is it's obviously a lot more interesting. You know, it's a lot more challenging. It's changing a lot quicker, and the value propositions are so much more interesting from a marketing perspective. You know, you've got a much more complex decision-making framework, a much more dynamic market. So, you know, as a challenge, if you like, as a marketing challenge, I think it's a lot more interesting than probably any B2C market.
Absolutely. And so, as you said, you know, back then there weren't many marketing degrees, so it would have been unusual for someone to actually study it and then go straight into that line of work. So, but that's exactly how you did that. So what advice would you give someone starting out today, their communications, marketing and PR career in IT, you know, someone looking to learn about brand development and ultimately reaching their customers through communications, wishing to help their sales team through marketing and PR, how would you suggest they start out?
You know, I think there's clearly no substitute for getting some kind of theoretical grounding in some kind of qualification. I think the principles of what I learned back in the 90s haven't really changed, although the way that's implemented, if you like, and even the way people consider and buy has changed dramatically. You know, people are still people and they still have the same motivations and drivers. The way in which they now research is very different. The way in which they're influenced is very different. So it's that combination of get that kind of basic grounding, but then it's really about starting to really understand how the marketing stack works, the marketing tech stack now works, and applying that, learning from great great mentors. You know, if you can find, someone was telling me the other day that they believed that your first two bosses really shaped the rest of your career. And I, you know, thinking back, I think that's probably certainly true for me. And talking to some of my colleagues, I think they would say the same thing. You learn so much if you can manage to hang on the coattails of somebody that really understands what they're doing and gives you the ability to learn and observe and, you know, make your own mistakes, if you like. I think that's really valuable.
I agree. I often think back to my initial bosses and, you know, we were in a different space. I was in comms, but in the hospitality space. Right. But still, there's always something you can learn, even if it's just your attitude towards how you do things and how you think about creativity, really. And sometimes in tech, it can be a little bit different. You know, being creative about an enterprise tech is very different to being creative about a phone or a pizza, you know, going back to your very start. But so what would you say is the one thing you must do to be successful in tech, comms and PR?
I think there's, well, maybe a couple of things. First, you have to really fundamentally understand what it is, what the proposition really is and what this technology actually delivers. It's really easy to get wrapped around the axle around speeds and feeds, for example, or, you know, why you're 10% slightly better in certain parameters than, you know, competitor X or Y. And that might be important. It might be fundamentally the differentiator that is going to change the world, but you have to really understand why. And so getting to that value, that real value proposition, and really understanding why the technology is delivering value is the critical piece. I think too often in tech, you do end up with this kind of speeds and feeds shoot off type mentality. And just because you're 10% better doesn't necessarily translate into, you know, true value. And I think that's probably one of the key things. And then really understanding, as I say, the basics of the technology that you're representing. And I do remember my first startup, after I'd been, you know, in the networking industry for about 10 years, I moved to a different technology space and really didn't fundamentally understand what it was I was trying to sell in truth, you know, and that that took me a long time to, you know, big learning curve to try and get my head around that. And, you know, I think that was a mistake, certainly.
I think that's very true, because often, especially enterprise tech, I find that at least I am told by salespeople that they are not really selling to tech people. They're selling to people who are more interested in productivity or cutting costs or, you know, CIOs, but rarely are these people who have a strong tech background. And so when you come to communicating what it is that you sell and how you address the problem that they may have, you really can't talk about bits and bytes, because that may not be the language that they talk. And
exactly,
not many PR and marketing people understand that. And no,
I think you're right. You know, we have an internal framework we use to help articulate what we're doing at SoftIron. And we kind of call it, you know, the CIO hierarchy of needs. And, you know, at the top layer of that, you know, the highest order need is actually delivering services to your, you know, to your customers as the CIO. That's ultimately what you're trying to do. But then below that, there are layer upon layer of technological pieces that enable you to either deliver efficiency or deliver elasticity in the way in which you deliver your services, and all the way down, you know, to the very base level need of, I just need some compute and some storage and a network to connect them together. But that's kind of the lowest order need, if you like. Everything else is about delivering that service in a way which is reliable, secure, you know, efficient, and ultimately, you know, a way in which that accelerates the business. And that's the kind of framework that we're trying to use as we try and explain what we're trying to do with HyperCloud, you know, the product we just launched.
Absolutely. And for our listeners who are not familiar with SoftIron, has been around a while and it's a global company. So you are based in the UK, Andrew, but you do look after the brand globally. Yeah. What would you say are the differences between doing marketing and PR in the US versus Europe or even the rest of the world?
Well, I think there's a few pieces. I think the speed of evolution, if you like, in technology varies dramatically as you move around the world. And so you have to, number one, be cognizant of where that particular market is in its evolution around whatever technology space you're operating in. And there can be 2-3 years, you know, and we often, I've often used this kind of idea here in Europe. You can almost draw a line north to south through Europe. And, you know, the further north you get on that line, the more advanced, if you like, or the further along the technology life cycle you'll find those markets are. And the further south you get, the less advanced they are. And there can be 2 or 3 years probably difference between the north of the north and the south of the south. And that, you know, that kind of theory works well around the world as well. I think also, if you're specifically thinking about the US and thinking about Europe, let's say, lots of other markets in the world, there's a key piece around the way relationships are built and the time you take to build a relationship before you even get to the point of actually talking about a project or selling something. You know, I think in the US, you get much more quickly to the point of actually where does the rubber hit the road? What product have you really got? Will it really solve my problem? And those relationships tend to form in parallel or even after that kind of basic transactional type part of the process. You know, a lot of the analysis, the research has been done up front before there's any people involved. I think that's different still here in Europe. And again, north of the north, south of the south, maybe slightly different and in different markets. But building relationship and building trust, I think, tends to come at the fore before you really think about any of the technology or the products or the individual project. Certainly much more over here.
I agree. It's very much the same for PR. You need to approach PR in very different ways depending on where in the world you're trying to reach customers. And sometimes US-based vendors, maybe who don't have much experience in PR, come to Europe and think that, especially in the UK, you can do exactly the same things you're doing in the US. And it doesn't work that way. Even just setting up, you know, sales, when they come and they think they can just hire people, and you go like, no, much better to get a channel partner and go down that route. And, you know, they're much more likely to know about sales than they are about PR. So it's definitely a bit of a struggle sometimes for us, yeah, on the PR side.
Yeah, but I guess at the same time, it's a global, the internet, I suppose, has made comms that much more global, and when you're small, it's hard to deliver that level of sophistication, I suppose, in the message. So you do need to, as you say, rely on local relationships, local partners, in order to help build and customize your proposition and position you best in that market space.
Absolutely. So as a CMO, you obviously have a broader role than, say, EMEA marketing director. How do you get at Soft Iron, for example, today, how do you get the sales, the engineering, and the marketing and PR teams to support each other? Because sometimes engineering wants to put something out because it's ready. Sales wants to put it out because they know their competitor may be coming out with something that's an alternative. And it may not work from a PR point of view or marketing, in terms of dates, for example. How do you get the three departments, the three teams, to work together successfully?
Well, you know, that's always a tough one, I think. And it doesn't matter whether you're a small organization or, you know, you're a multinational. There's always going to be a bunch of trade-offs in all of that. And again, maybe it also is reflective of where you are in the market and the expectations of customers in terms of when you're announcing something, for example. So I think the only thing you can do really is you know, open those lines of communication. So we, one thing that we've done within our organization at Softiron is we actually have a team of engineers that work inside marketing, which, you know, I don't know how unusual that is these days in a technology company, but certainly it's very important within our organization, because there's two parts to delivering value for a customer. There's the basic product platform, if you like, and then there's the ability to utilize that platform. And so one of the things we have is a team of engineers within marketing whose only job really is to demonstrate the power of the platform that we're, you know, that we're bringing to market. And I don't mean just, you know, demonstrate it. I mean, actually develop templates and examples and partnerships with other vendors to show how we integrate with, you know, other key players in the market, you know, those kinds of capabilities, you know, to go out and work at demonstrating in meetups and engineering conferences and the like. I think you have to kind of, I think in any kind of organization, and especially if you're a growing, you know, fast growing startup like Softiron, you have to work hard to remove any of those barriers so everyone's on the same page and you're kind of all working to the same goal. You don't really have time to do anything else. But then organizing, as I'm describing here, you know, we've kind of broken down a barrier between engineering and marketing by actually having some engineers who technically work in marketing, even though they're engineers. So I think that's been very valuable for us, certainly.
It certainly sounds so. Obviously, you've worked in larger companies. RSA became part of EMC, obviously 3Com earlier on in your career. And today, you work for a smaller company. And we have a number of startups among our listeners. When it comes to developing PR, when you don't have a dedicated marketing team, you know, sometimes you don't even have a marketing person. You know, it could be the founders that are supposed to put the company on the map. What advice would you give a startup that has no budget for a PR agency? They may not have, you know, days and days every month to devote to marketing. What advice would you give them to get started and begin to build the foundation of what will become a marketing strategy?
Well, I guess the first thing is you're never going to outspend the big guys. So trying to throw money at the problem is not going to be a successful strategy. So it then has to be about the strength of the message that you're taking to the market and being very targeted, I think, in who, you know, you want to receive that message. So that could be geographically, it could be a specific class of individual, let's say. And then kind of using guerrilla marketing techniques effectively to try and deliver that message most effectively, you know. Social is a good example. You know, right now in tech, I'd say LinkedIn is probably the most powerful of the free platforms. I think there's always an interesting trade. The startups that I've worked for and worked in, very often actually, it's easier to build a brand for an individual in the company than it is to build a brand for the company itself. You know, people buy from people and people trust people more than they trust companies, you know, trust the brand. And so it might actually be for some organizations building the profile of the CEO, the CTO, whoever it happens to be, you know, the influencer in your business, and focusing on them rather than the company and letting the company get pulled through on the back of that individual. Can be a successful strategy. You know, I can think of one or two guys in our organization who've got very strong presence on social, in particular on LinkedIn. And the other beauty, I think, of that kind of strategy, and one I think that helps really drive differentiation and help build brand, is you can have an opinion that would never get through a large corporate. You know, the, one of the downsides of being in a large corporation is everything's going to get signed off by 27 people, and you'll end up with something that's been diluted from the original message in a way which means it's not as effective fundamentally. You can afford to have opinion and have strong opinion and rail against the industry and say something controversial, especially if you're building brand for an individual. So that that I think is definitely worth considering, because you can do that if, you know, opinion costs you nothing, if you like, from a budget point of view, and using social to get that opinion out and cause a conversation, you know, have that engagement, that is incredibly powerful. And you can build on that.
It's really interesting what you're saying. You are the first person to have mentioned LinkedIn as a tool for startups. And I think you're right bang on the money, because it is such a fast-growing tool. So how do you use it for the benefit of the organization as a corporate comms tool when you're relying on colleagues and executives to push the message? Because, of course, you need to make sure that, in a way, in quotation marks, they are toeing the line. They are pushing the corporate message. Do you have a messaging document that you share? Do you train them into how to use LinkedIn and other social media channels for the benefit of the organization? Forget about the startups. You as a company today, how do you use LinkedIn to make sure you're growing your brand and not, you know, doing an Elon Musk where he just goes out and cuts off millions of dollars off the share price because of something he said on social media?
It's funny. I mean, one of the beauties, of course, of being not traded, not publicly traded, is there's no risk of that happening. So the downside is relatively small in that respect. But what we do is we kind of think through think of each of the execs, let's say, you know, as the kind of the key people who are doing this as having their own spheres of influence, if you like. And those spheres of influence will obviously intersect and you know, cross over in certain areas. But what we'll try and do is have different individuals in the organization focus on different areas. So if I take our CEO, Jason Vanderskay, for example, he's leading our work in the national security space right now and doing a lot of work in Australia. So anything which is really about national security and about our growth in the Australian market right now, we're doing a lot of work down there. We've just opened a factory. And so that's a big area of focus for us in Australia. You know, we'll center the message from Jason in the first person, if you like, and come from his LinkedIn profile, and he'll write that, or we'll help write that. But then we'll amplify that back into the corporate account from there. And then, you know, each of us as individuals will amplify that into our own spheres of influence as well. So we kind of think through what are those spheres of influence that we want to build around individuals, and how do those intersect? And then when does it make sense to send a message from the corporate account and then amplify it, you know, the individuals amplify it with their own spin on it, or vice versa. And so that's kind of how we work it through.
Absolutely. Sometimes, you know, it's, you said, you know, the advantage of not being listed is that, you know, the damage would only be small. To a certain extent, though, because, you know, it's still a case of building. For startups, for example, you're building a brand. You want people to get to know the team behind the brand. And if someone comes out with something rather controversial, I think that could be a bit of a faux pas. But
oh, for sure.
Luckily, people tend to not do that.
I think, you know, you're... The risk model, if you like, when there's only a handful of people who are realistically have enough influence to do that, is, you know, that your risk profile is relatively small. It's not like you have hundreds or thousands of people you need to worry about, and, you know, and a basic shareholder. So I mean, within bounds, of course, you have to still obviously be careful. But I think, you know, if you're all aligned around what messages are really important, and, you know, the key positioning statements, if you like, that we're trying to reinforce, then I think, you know, the risk becomes substantially less.
Fair enough. What about if you're trying to attract channel partners? You are trying to build a company, to build a market share, to increase a footprint generally. Mm-hmm. How have you used PR and marketing in the past to win over channel partners, to get interest from distributors, VARs, resellers, and that part of the industry?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely build some parts of our messaging specifically for channel partners. I think that, you know, the IT channel in general at the moment is not necessarily a particularly fun place to be for a lot of partners right now. You know, margins are getting squeezed. The power that some of those larger brands are wielding over the channel isn't particularly healthy. And many channel partners are now looking for a different model, if you like, a different way to run their business, and or different propositions to bring into the market, not, you know, yet another unknown brand that, you know, maybe delivers 10% better performance than the existing brands are already working with. They're looking for something that's fundamentally different to bring to their existing customers that can help fundamentally change, you know, change their business. And that, I think, you know, building messages and strategy around that, and building a compelling partner program and articulating that, has been important. And that's kind of working for us. You know, we were just in the last few weeks, you know, we were one of CRN's 20 coolest cloud infrastructure companies. Phil Crocker, our chief revenue officer, was named channel chief for I don't know how many years in a row at this point, but we're certainly getting recognition both for the program we've put together and, you know, the differentiation that we're bringing into the market. And so we do definitely focus on the kind of channel related press and that proposition, and what we can deliver for the partner as much as we can for the customer, with a different kind of proposition.
And that's the crux of it. You need to adapt your messaging to your audience. With this in mind, what's the first thing you do when you're given a new piece of tech to promote, bearing in mind that you will eventually need to develop a draw towards this technology from different audiences? What's the first thing you do?
No, well, it's a good question, because I think there's kind of understanding the technology, but then there's also understanding what does this technology deliver. You know, what ultimately is the problem that it will solve, and in a fundamentally different way to whatever else is already out in the marketplace itself. And it isn't necessarily product versus product. It could be actually, it dramatically changes the skills required, for example, to build a solution. And so I think really getting under the skin of that and understanding that proposition is important. And then trying to really map out who would be involved in the conversation around adopting that technology. You know, who are the decision makers? Who are the influencers? What are those personas? And as we map out how they would research and evaluate this new piece of tech, what are the roadblocks they're going to hit, if you like? What are the inflection points that we need to identify so that we have, if you like, on a plate, delivered to them the piece of information or the asset required to help move them along that buying cycle. So I think that's kind of a key piece for me. You know, we're at a point now, I think everybody or all the major analysts talk about customers being 40% the way down the buying cycle before you even get to talk to them. You know, just think about the way you bought the last, you know, expensive thing for your home. You know, you do a bunch of research online, you read a bunch of reviews, you look for peer reviews, you look for technical specs and technical analysis, and buying technology is no different. You know, in the B2B world, you look for those trusted advisors, the analysts, the reports, you know, the video if you're someone who learns via video versus audio versus reading, because that's the other piece, of course. We all learn differently and look for information in different ways. And so planning that out and trying to build up those assets for those different parts of that buying cycle and for those different individuals that are going to be associated with making that decision or influencing that decision.
Absolutely. So the technology that you promote today for soft iron is cloud. What's the next big trend in the cloud industry, in your opinion?
Sure. Yeah, so soft iron, we kind of pivoted back at the beginning of September of last year, of 2022, to hypercloud, which in essence is now kind of the simplest, most efficient and uniquely sovereign way you can build your own cloud infrastructure. So we found a way essentially to deliver the entire cloud consumption experience on-premise, so a customer can build in half a rack, half a day, their own multi-tenant cloud and start hosting applications and users super quickly. And that's never been done before. So to answer your question, really, why is that important? So one of the big trends that we're seeing is this trend towards data repatriation. I think kind of the honeymoon is over with public cloud, and no one's saying public cloud's going away at all, obviously. But I think there's this power that the public cloud vendors have been wielding over many customers that customers are now starting to rail against. You know, they're finding that they're not saving the amount of money that they expected they'd save. The complexity they thought they were going to get rid of has actually been replaced with different types of complexity. And so this idea of building a hybrid cloud model is pretty ubiquitous at this point, that larger organizations in particular, all the way down to medium-sized enterprises, all want to build a cloud-like experience that lives in their own data center and then complement that with public cloud and move data and workloads to the place where they are most efficiently held. So that kind of data repatriation, we call it the great repatriation internally, because that's kind of how it feels as customers start to try and redress this balance between public and private. So that's a really big one. You know, universally and again, ubiquitous in the industry is this skills crisis. But, you know, there's just a lack of high quality IT skills. So building infrastructure, if I'm going to have to build infrastructure and run it myself, it needs to be in a way that the complexity has been abstracted away, so I can just use IT generalists to build and run my infrastructure. That's something we've been heavily focused on in building hypercloud to enable that, which means then that the more sophisticated engineers you have, you can deploy those to actually, instead of just keeping the lights on, those guys can actually deliver against business objectives. And that's, I think, again, a key strategy. You know, everybody's kind of moving to this cloud first model, but cloud first isn't necessarily now synonymous with public cloud first. It's building that experience and then placing it in the right location for the business. So that's a big one. The second big one I mention is again associated with this dominance of the public cloud guys, you know, kind of the big four, because what we're definitely seeing around the world is a shift to much more diversity in cloud service provision. So whether that's sovereign clouds, where, you know, you're building and running a cloud service within a specific geography, housed within that geography, you know, in the case of if it's built on soft iron, might have even been manufactured in that country. So Australia, again, is a good example. We manufacture everything in the US and Australia right now, incidentally. That's a key part of what makes us as different. And it's very important for these kind of sovereign projects. But even outside of sovereign cloud, we're seeing a lot more cloud service provision that's focused in specific geographies or specific industries or specific use cases. And I think that's a trend that we'll see evolve over the next few years as well, as people look for value, but also look for specialism that, that kind of meets their specific needs, as opposed to, you know, defaulting to, you know, a ubiquitous public cloud vendor and handing all of your strategy effectively to a single cloud provider. So that, I think that's probably the next big one. So we've got skills, we've got this kind of diversification in the cloud service market, and then this data repatriation, I think, let's call it, as kind of the three big trends, I would say.
Absolutely. And the thing with data repatriation is also the fact that companies that had not planned to go down that route often are faced with egress fees, which are way higher than they had budgeted for. So and that is putting off other companies from going towards an all cloud strategy.
Yeah, you know, I think it's highly unusual at this point, I'd say, to find organizations who are now saying we're going 100% public cloud. I think there's always good reasons that that isn't going to work for many, many, especially larger organizations. There are plenty of applications and workloads that just will never live happily in the public cloud. They need to be on-prem, whether that's for regulatory reasons, performance reasons, or that, you know, some legacy applications just aren't architected to work well in public cloud. And that isn't going away anytime soon. But then this egress fees thing, this out of control scenario where it's cheap to put your data in the cloud, but it's expensive to get it back. You know, a lot of organizations have been bitten badly by that and are looking for ways to redress that for sure.
Absolutely. Well, we'll have to talk again in a year or so and see how that went.
Absolutely.
This brings us to the end of this episode of E3 Communications, Who Do You Think You Are? Thank you for joining us today, Andrew.
Thanks, Fred. It was great. Thank you for inviting me on.
You're very welcome. A reminder for our listeners that you can find the list of podcasts in this series at e3communicationspr.com. This is Fred Monson. Thank you for listening and see you in our next episode of E3 Communications, Who Do You Think You Are?